Support for Soundwaves from the Underground is brought to you by 24tix.com, the most convenient way to buy tickets to your favorite local concerts. Save time, save money, rock out. 24tix.com, your ticket to the experience.
Slug Magazine.
Hello, Ricky Vigil.
How did you know it was me?
I'm psychic.
You're psychic. Who's this? I'm not. I was trying to say something clever, but I'm not very clever right now.
Don't cry.
I'll do my best.
There's no tears in baseball.
That's true. I don't play baseball.
I'm Dan Nalen, and this is Soundwaves from the Underground, the official podcast of Slug Magazine in Salt Lake City, Utah. Slug is an acronym for Salt Lake Underground, and it's one of the oldest independent publications in the United States, distributing free monthly issues about music, art, action, sports, and subculture. On this episode, we'll talk about Martha Hayden, who just had a dinosaur named after her. We'll talk about Bad Wolf Style and One Face Watch. Martha Hayden is currently the assistant to the Utah paleontologist. She recently had a new raptor that was discovered in Utah named after her in recognition of all the work she's done to help discover new dinosaurs all over Utah. In case you didn't know, Utah is pretty much a real-life Jurassic Park out there. Slug's managing editor, Esther Moronio, chatted with Hayden right here in the Soundwave studio about her career and about the new dinosaur, which is called the Martha Raptor greenriverensis.
I think that a lot of people's impressions of paleontology is kind of based off of Steven Spielberg films.
Uh-huh.
And so if you could tell me a little bit about what you do and what it's really like to work in the field.
Okay. Your experience. I actually now work mostly in the office.
Okay.
And I found this site, you know, back probably about 2004, 2005, when I used to do more field work. And it's fun. I mean, I'm like getting a little too old, and I don't really, it's a little too hard on me being out in the field, because
yeah,
the places we go in Utah, we're usually driving in on dirt roads, you know, pretty far from anything. We have to haul everything in, including our water, and camp out for long periods of time. And it goes from like weather like this, the rest of the paleo crew, they're actually heading out in the field for a couple days.
Wow, and
now
and
they're going to stay in a motel and then go out. But, you know, it's like all spring it'll be freezing cold and you get rained on and snowed on. And then all of a sudden it's 110 degrees. And then there's a rainstorm and, we've had our camp totally blow down more than a few times.
Wow.
And have to go and get my tent from up on the side of the hill.
Yeah.
Things like that. So it's, you know, not the glamour. And usually when they're out there, these guys, especially when it's over 100 degrees, you know, you start working kind of early in the morning before it gets too hot.
Yeah.
And we usually set up shade tarps over where we're working because, you know, it really, when you're in 100 degree heat and it's not any shade in sight, you know, you have to kind of make your shade.
So how did you get involved? Did you go to school?
Well, I actually, that's why I'm an assistant. I have a degree in anthropology, and when I was first out of college back in 79, I was like, okay, what do I want to do? And I started working actually for the very first state paleontologist, Jim Madsen. He's actually the guy that wrote the book on Allosaurus, which is our state fossil.
Cool.
And he was the first ever state paleontologist, which at the time, we used to be over there, right over here in Rio Grande Depot with the state archaeologist.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started working for him way back then when he retired. Dave Gillette was my boss as the second state paleontologist, and now I work for Jim Kirkland, who his specialty is working in the Cedar Mountain Formation where this dinosaur is from. So,
okay.
So I sort of fell into the job, you know, like unlike my boss, kind of an interesting thing. We're both graduated from the same high school in Marshfield, Massachusetts.
Oh, wow.
And both ended up here, so it's kind of an odd coincidence.
Yeah.
And actually our whole paleo group were all from Massachusetts originally, so.
Wow.
It's kind of funny. So he's always wanted to be a paleontologist. This is just what I've ended up doing. I mean, I've always had an interest in kind of the natural history sort of thing.
As the assistant to the paleontologist, what kinds of things do you do? Obviously, you go out on site sometimes.
Yeah, I used to do that a lot more. We have a little bigger staff now of people that go out in the field more. So what I mainly do is all, you know, kind of why we have a state paleontologist, the laws, you know, that require that we mitigate fossils, like if they're going to build a road, you know, you got to say, okay, destroy a fossil, you need to go excavate it. And so I maintain a database and, you know, use ArcMap to maintain our locality data for the whole state of Utah. We actually work with the BLM and have a data repository agreement with them, so that's what I do. And we also have a volunteer group called the Utah Friends of Paleontology, which we use a lot of those volunteers in the field, but we're kind of the sponsor of that group of volunteers.
Fossils, like how does someone find a dinosaur?
Well, once you start looking in a certain area, like this site, the original site was the Falcarius, which it's on display up at the New Natural History Museum in Utah. That site was found back in the, you know, late 1990s by an amateur, you know, who was actually selling the claws from this site and ended up turning it over. But that was the first site in this whole area, which is about 5 miles or so southeast of Green River, kind of out in the desert. It's all Morris and Badlands, but there's the Cedar Mountain Formation, which 50 years ago they said there's no fossils in it because they hadn't found any. But now that they're looking, I mean, a year before the Martha Raptor was published, another site nearby, the Falcarius cult, they published a new dinosaur called Gemini Raptor, which is after two twins who were geologists and paleontologists who found that site. And these two sites, the Falcarius, Crystal Geyser Dinosaur Quarry, the Suarez twins who found the Gemini Raptor site, were doing geology, and they found this other site that's now called the Suarez site. And I was actually just walking, taking a volunteer to visit this other site and look at it, and we were on our way back and found the little site where the Martha Raptor. And that's why they don't really know much about it yet, because there were really only a couple dozen bones. It was just a tiny little hill, you know, an area about as big as this room. And actually, when I got back, we were working at Crystal Geyser, and I told Jim, my boss, I said, I found, you know, the first thing I found was a claw.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of cool that I just picked it up out of, you know, here's a claw. And they went back and said, oh, there wasn't much there. But a couple years later, we were doing a field trip for it was actually the Friends of Paleo annual meeting, and we'll do field trips and things like that. And we actually had the paleontologist, Robert Barker, with us. And let's go and stop and see if. And Jim actually said, oh, I think we collected everything. But we went back and, you know, more stuff had eroded out, and they collected about two dozen or so bones. So it was enough to know it's a new animal because it's in a different layer, and mm-hmm. it was different enough. And I think it was the scapula and a few other bones like that. But until they actually find another specimen somewhere else, you know, they won't know, you know, exactly what it is. Like I say, when they published it, they thought it was another therizinosaur like the Falcarius. Now, my boss just got back from Society of Vertebrate Paleontology meeting, the annual meeting of vertebrate paleontologists, talking about it. They now actually think it's an oviraptor, which are the dinosaurs they used to call the egg stealers. So actually, they don't know exactly what it is, and there's, you know, until they find more, like at another site. Like the Gemini Raptor site actually has more of the Falcarius bones, but until they discovered the Crystal Geyser Quarry, that was a brand new dinosaur.
So tell me a little bit more about it. I know that, you know, you didn't find a lot, so there isn't a lot of information, but what do you do know? And I'm sure a lot of our listeners aren't really familiar with, you know, scientific terms, so if you want to...
Well, they know it's a theropod, or what we call the meat-eating dinosaurs, mm-hmm. but the interesting thing about the therizinosaurs is they were the meat-eaters that were sort of evolving to become plant-eaters.
Oh.
And that's why they had the big guts, you know, that's, you know, the tubby dinosaur reference. The Falcarius and another dinosaur that's a little later that my boss worked on in New Mexico called Nothronicus is another one of these therizinosaurs that was evolving to be plant eaters.
Okay.
So they have the big bellies to digest plant material, you know, it's harder to digest.
Yeah.
So, but like the Falcarius has kind of small teeth, but the claws like a meat-eating dinosaur.
Utah has a really rich prehistoric history. How many new dinosaurs get discovered a year, do you think?
We've actually, the last couple of years, quite a few. You know, the Museum of Natural History has been working in Grand Staircase. Uh-huh. And we have done some work down there, too. And we named a new ceratopsian, you know, related mm-hmm. to Triceratops. And they found three. And then in the Cedar Mountain, I mean, Falcarius is probably between 5 and 10 years, whenever that was published 10 years ago. We started working there. Since then, between Falcarius, Gemini Raptor, Martha Raptor, Hippodraco, I think is a new duckbill type dinosaur, Iguanodon dinosaur. So, you know, a lot. I guess a couple years ago, the BLM put out a press release where that year they had described 8 new species. So when you start looking at an area that, you know, 50 years ago, they said, oh, there's no dinosaurs in the Cedar Mountain, you know. It's right above the Morrison, which is where Dinosaur National mm-hmm. Monument, and so Allosaurus and the, you know, long-necked dinosaurs that we're more familiar with in Utah.
Yeah.
But once they started finding, you know, looking, there's a, you know, pretty rich history of dinosaurs and other animals in the Cedar Mountain Formation.
Do you think that there's a lot more to be discovered?
Oh, yeah. Barely scratched the surface of how many different animals actually lived during that whole time period, so, yeah.
How does it work to name a dinosaur? Is there, like, a rule? Is it first come, first serve?
There's a process. You have to, you know, you have to get, like, the Martha Raptor was going to be Rio Verdensis, or something like that, which is sort of Spanish or Latin for Green River. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, somebody said no, and they changed it to Green Riverensis. They often use name people, you know, like one of the new ceratopsians, the species is Gedii after the person who found it. And they often name it after characteristics, like our ceratopsian, they named it Diabloceratops, which ceratops means horned face, is the Triceratops group, mm-hmm. and Diablo is Spanish for devil horn because of the way the horns, you know, uh-huh. So there's a process to what they, you know, usually by location, like Green River, naming it after a person who found it, you know, in honor of them, you know.
So what's it like having a dinosaur named after you?
Oh, it's, you know, I mean, sometimes, you know, you're like, oh, why did I get recognition for this? But then when you do, you're like, why do you have to, you know, do that, call attention to, you know? So kind of, you know, mixed feelings, you know. You know, you do like to give credit for things. And uh-huh. on the other hand, it is a little bit, you know, embarrassing.
I think it's really cool. Yeah. I'd be bragging about it all the time.
I mean, this is the first thing I know I found that's a new species, but like the Falcarius site, when we first went there were a lot of claws had been found, but we had to find something that would be, they call it the holotype, the actual bone that they used to describe the dinosaur, and what we were looking for something, and I actually did find that. It was the brain case, which is the base of the skull where the, you know, where the, has the occipital condyle, where mm-hmm. the vertebral column attaches to the head. And I actually did find that bone from that site. So I found things in the past, but I think this was the first dinosaur I think I found that, you know, ended up being a new animal mm-hmm. that...
For more detailed information on the new raptor and where it was found, search out Martha Raptor Green Riverensis on plosone.org. Accidente is a four-piece hardcore band from Salt Lake City that was formed out of a group of former Form of Rocket members. The band released their debut album, Exotic Payday, in January 2008, and have been playing off and on over the past 5 years, most recently bringing guitarist David Payne into the band. In October of this year, the band released their follow-up, Headless, on the newly revived Exigent Records. This is a song called Pundit from their brand new album, Headless.
Yeah.
To download the complete album for a mere $8, visit Exigent Records' new online store at exigentrecords.bandcamp.com. To learn more about the band and current plans, search for Exidente on Facebook. Bad Wolf Style is a clothing line started by designer Tina Richard. Richard started her own line of creations out of Southern California and marketed almost exclusively online. More recently, she's been donating Bad Wolf creations to Pibbs Exchange in Salt Lake City to provide those with constrained budgets an affordable fashion. Slug writer Isha B sat down with Richard to talk about her career and fashion in general.
Tell us who you are and what you do.
I've been going by Wolf just to keep things a little more consistent with my label. I've got a small line, a startup company called Bad Wolf Style. I'm the designer and the vision behind it. I've used my own snowboarding riding style, which is the vintage 70s sort of wool Fila pant. I've got the jumpsuit and like a skinny pant and worn with sweatered base layers. And I've used my own riding style to develop a line that can be worn as women's mid layers, and then when you get home, you've got really cute loungewear that you can wear out to the bar. Started that way.
Was that what piqued your interest in fashion, or has this been something that you've been interested in for a long time?
Sewing has been pretty much a long life sort of hobby that turned into a career, just from people liking what I had, and I was like, well, there's an opportunity to make a little bit extra cash. But the line that I was just talking about is actually something new. It's something I'm just doing right now.
That's exciting.
Yeah, for the ski season, I'm really excited because it's the graphics. The graphics is the best part. I get to use my friends, all of my friends that are artists. I get to finally give them a lot of credit. I'm always looking at their stuff and just going, oh, you're so cool, you're so cool. So I hooked up with these guys. They're right in Salt Lake. They print T-shirts, Rocky Mountain Hardcore.
Awesome.
Yeah, they're so good. They're so good there. They hook me up with stickers and really great deals all the time, and they like to work with poor people like me. But anyways, we're going to use some of my friends' art.
Make some shirts.
Yeah.
I love it. That's awesome.
It's really great. It's a good opportunity for other artists to get out there, too, and for me to get my clothing line out there with some really great graphics.
Very cool. So So, I mean, just listening to you chatting, it doesn't sound like you originally maybe intended on pursuing a traditional career in fashion. Did you know from the start of what you've been working on that you wanted to do something involving fashion ethics, or was that just kind of an accident?
I've always wanted to just work on a team. Like, I'd love to get in with NAF or with as a freelance kind of designer with
right
my ideas. I'd love to get that patent. But I've wound up being alone, just doing a lot of solo stuff because I don't have the true industry background. But I've learned to wear more hats. Like, I learned the ethics when I was researching my fabric. But I would have, if I worked in a big company to start out with right out of college, and I perhaps wouldn't have learned some of the background stuff that I found in spoofing, doing my own research.
That is cool. It's all about perspective, huh? Can you explain fashion ethics a little? What do fashion ethics mean to you?
Well, I think that that would be responsibility of the designer, hopefully using sustainable fabrics and textiles, or at least buying American fabric, American-made. That's a good start. A lot of designers are using really green fabrics like bamboo or organic cotton. That's a big one with designers. I think just looking out for the source of your fabric, trying to reuse. I love using vintage. You can make great patterns from vintage and save money also. So I think that's another way you can have ethics, looking out for the environment, looking out for others.
Talking about your t-shirts, what other products do you offer?
We're actually doing the lounge series. It's called Ride by Wolf, and it's designed not only to be versatile for riding and give you some winter warmth and comfort, but it's also to be worn out. So we've actually got some of the screened art on our first series is on these beautiful silk shirts that are vintage, that are sourced from California. I do this go back thing. I go back. I get to be out of California. I'm here for about a month or so, and then I come back to Salt Lake with really, really great vintage finds from scouring all the thrift stores. And I usually put a few on my website, and then I bring whatever kind of extras that are cute but aren't as high-end vintage. Then I'll put those into Pibs or in. I'm talking to Blue Boutique too, and just trying to get them around town just so that people get some good finds.
It sounds like a lot of buying and styling as well, but you do design and handcraft some of the items yourself?
Oh, absolutely. My original lines were mostly jackets, so they would sell in the Portland industry, Portland area. Some of those thrift stores are famous for designers. One of them, I think her name was Leanne. Her brand is Leanimal, and she actually was on Project Runway.
Oh, I met her because I that's awesome. That is
oh,
way
yeah.
fun.
So we sold in some of the same boutiques.
That is
so,
very cool.
She did really beautiful. She had a very feminine, softer style.
Yeah.
I do more angular. I was really inspired by semi-trucks. I do really geometric, angular, a lot of top stitching, bright colors, a lot of high collars, and weird cuffs. My friend, my buddy Nate, he was one of the shop owners back then. He said, oh my gosh, anytime you want to go watch a speed racer and look at semi-trucks, you can do that whenever you want. It's kind of my guilty pleasure to go sit out at the freeway and look at semi-trucks and copy their graphics.
Oh my gosh,
they're painted so awesome, like 70s race cars.
Well, you beat me to it because I was going to have you describe your aesthetic, so it sounds like that's what you have going on right now. Is that kind of your overall vision? Or?
Oh my gosh. Such a nerd. I love sci-fi, and I love video game art graphics. I had a friend who worked for Blizzard, and he was actually on the World of Warcraft team. I get exposed to some really amazing artists. Like I'm saying, so these sweaters, they're not just sweaters. Like I know some really cool artists. The graphics on these sweaters, limited edition, they'll all be batches under 50, and they'll be at like some of the snowboard shops at Selby Peaks, and even IME has offered to carry my line.
Super cool.
But they'll be limited, so I'm just going to throw them out into the Salt Lake Valley, and then you got to go and run and grab them.
Got to go get them for sure. Well, that's always the best way to get them anyway. One of a kind, baby. With your emphasis on kind of doing things differently, should people expect an entirely different fashion experience, or are there some things that you do the same for example, do you do seasons? Do you do fashion shows?
Yeah, we actually would like to do kind of a fashion show auction. And whenever we put out a new artist, we'd love to do kind of a fashion show thing, maybe just the showing of it, the garments, so everybody will know what they look like, and then they'll be scattered among everyone. You'll have a chance to bid for them, but then we'll just scatter them into the Salt Lake Abyss and maybe a few in California and we can run and get the rest. So there'll be some really, really standout pieces where there's only one of, and then there'll be the plain white tees. Everybody's got to have some comfort tees and tanks. So we do want to stay kind of consistent for the fall and the winter and really pushing the look, which is the style. You'll definitely find some layering systems, some one-of-a-kind handmade jackets, and some dresses. I love doing holiday dresses. I did a line all in this beautiful espresso velveteen with a few red dresses and a little red riding hood coat with blue. It had this beautiful blue floral print on the inside, and I sold this to my friend JC.
Delicious.
Lots of compliments on it. I'll see if I can find any of those images.
So cute.
To see more of Richard's styles, check out her shop at Etsy.com/shop/badwolfstyle. This is your weekly daily calendar for November 20th through November 26th. As always, check out slugmag.com for daily new additions, and you can have your events on there for free just by clicking in. You can also add some new content for a mere $5 a month or $50 a year. Add some multimedia, some photos, whatever you like. Be sure to check back daily. There's always new things going on. On Wednesday, November 21st, The Coup, radical leftist hip-hop straight out of Oakland, led by Boots Riley, one of the baddest man in the business, alongside DJ Pam the Funkstress. Their new album is super hot. Sorry to bother you. It came out just this month. They're one of the best live bands I've seen in a few years from a hip-hop group. It's more like a big fat funk show, and I recently saw Boots Riley get on stage with Tom Morello in San Francisco and start rapping some Woody Guthrie lyrics. It was pretty sick. They're playing at the State Room on Wednesday, November 21st. Also on Wednesday, November 21st, Death Clock, that cartoon metal band out of Metalocalypse on the Adult Swim Network. They're playing out at the Saltaire. Not the best venue around, but probably one of the best shows you'll find that week. Thursday, November 22nd, gobble gobble, it's Thanksgiving. And after you've had your family Thanksgiving and tried not to kill each other, you can go down to Willie's, enjoy the ultra-cheap beer in town, and get more free Thanksgiving grub all night long. That's at Willie's on Thursday, November 22nd. On Friday, November 23rd, I'm going to suggest you go check out the Salt Lake Acting Company's new production called Manning Up. It's a comedy involving a couple of guys and how they react to becoming fathers. Should be a good one. Slack is always great when they do a comedy. On Saturday, November 24th, one of my personal favorite local bands, Future of the Ghost, are celebrating what we think is maybe their 60-year anniversary at the Urban Lounge. It might be 5, it might be 6, somewhere in there. Regardless, it'll be a bunch of great tunes. You can get a bunch of their music for free online if you search it out. On November 26th, Monday night, Rick Estrin and the Nightcats are playing at Sun and Moon Cafe. They're actually playing on Sunday night, the 25th as well. These guys, a great harmonica player. I'm going to hazard a guess I might see Bad Brad Wheeler at this show. And if you've never gone to anything up at the Sun and Moon Cafe, it's pretty cool. You kind of chill, eat some good grub, and they throw some traditional rockabilly or blues in the corner, usually something really high quality. Also, Sunday, November 25th, the Geek Show movie night is at Broovies, where you can get two free movies for the price of none. It's free. So go check it out. You can always trust those guys to come up with something good. It might even be holiday themed, I would hazard a guess, given that it's the Sunday after Thanksgiving and we're heading into the Christmas season. As always, be sure to go to slugmag.com, check out the daily calendar for anything you need to know about what's going on in and around Salt Lake City.
I think I'm good enough for you.
Robert and the Carols are a 6-piece indie folk pop band from Provo, Utah. The band formed in the summer of 2008 and in 2012 released their debut self-titled EP, quietly releasing the album exclusively to iTunes. Earlier this month, the band released their second self-titled EP. This is a song called It's a Foggy Place off of that new self-titled EP from Robert and the Carols.
The call, I didn't expect her to talk to my my door. Leave the rest for you. You met me last night in the parking lot. You told me I had one good shot with you. I can't explain, no, how it feels to lose something not even yours at all. It's a funny place, I know. I jumped into a hole and I hit the bottom last night. I looked through the glass. If I could trace a pattern, my fingers down a sea of that jars, my hand is trembling. That grows between and cracks disappears as I'm calling you back.
To find out more about the band and their albums, visit them online at robertandthecarols.com, and that's Carols with two R's and two L's. One Face Watch is a new charitable campaign just started this summer, July 2012. The campaign sells $40 watches that simply tell the time and have simple designs that work with any outfit or ensemble. The watches come in different colors, and depending on what color you choose, your money goes towards one of six very worthy charitable causes, such as AIDS research, breast cancer research, feeding hungry children, or providing charcoal-efficient stoves to needy families. Slug writer Ben Trentleman chatted with the campaign's founder, Fam Mirza, about the watches and the work they've already done in raising money for these charitable causes.
What was the motivation behind One Face Watches? What can you tell me about the watches?
I grew up in a third world country until I was about nine. So that was one of the main things that was behind it. You know, I've had a lot of products in the past and a lot of large projects, but I always wanted to do something, you know, which would benefit the world, per se. I wanted to use my talents to do something with it. And it, you know, it just came about. It's just weird that it came about with a watch, you know, it turned into a social good product. When we originally designed this, actually, it was back in 2009 is when we redesigned this. SB Works were the first people to design the Mira watch. So I always say that we're not the original designers of the Mira, but we redesigned it and made it that much better, made it what you see now. After this was, you know, redesigned and whatnot, it was always like that Mira aspect of it.
Okay.
Always stood out to me, as it stands out to a lot of people. And, you know, every time you take a look at the watch, it's like you see your face in it. So it's kind of what created the brand, was that aspect of the watch. And that's what, I guess, resonates with the consumer. That's where the whole slogan came from.
Okay.
Changing the world one face at a time, because you see your face every time you check the time.
So with the watches and the design for the watch, how did you come up with something that went to produce in order to ensure that a significant amount of the profit went towards the charities in mind?
Everything that I design, I always try to keep it a very minimalistic approach on everything. You know, it just has a very simple design. When you create the product with that simplicity in mind, you know, obviously manufacturing costs are not a lot. To design, to create, you know, per se, it's not a lot.
All right.
To manufacture that.
Awesome. How do you choose the charities that will benefit from One Face?
We chose the charities. So first it was, how are we going to relay this to the consumer, right? How are we going to, you know, what's the best way to do it? Color coding was the easiest way to do it. As far as we brought the charities in, because we're not a charity, you know, we're a marketing firm,
yeah.
Right? And we don't have charity dollars, nor do we ever claim to have it. So at the end of the day, we didn't want to set up like a Tom's model where he runs his own charity. There's just too much going on there because we have different projects and whatnot. So I pretty much called in the experts, and you know, we did our due diligence on all these charities. You know, I would say three of our charities are pretty much the biggest charities in the nation. These are just people. We looked at the 990 forms, analyzed, you know, where they're, how much of the money goes to their projects, comparable to how much of the money goes to their own pockets. So,
okay.
Yeah, those charities are very trustable charities, and they do great groundwork. I'm a big fan of like One Day's Wages. I'm a big fan of Charity Water and their past projects.
Can you tell me what the other charities are as well?
So it's One Day's Wages with the Hunger. We have Charity Water, obviously, for the water. We have American Cancer Society on the cancer aspect of things. We have National Breast Cancer Association with the Breast Cancer Adventure Project. Actually, Becky Straw is actually a good friend of mine. She was one of the first people at Charity Water, and then she left to start her own thing, which is the Adventure Project. And they have a really cool project, which they do for the environment. You know, so, like, there's a lot of charities out there that say that they benefit the environment, but it's always something that's hard. There's no, like, metrics. There's no performance metrics on it, and Becky's been able to do it where she does have a performance metric. How are you saving the environment? By providing charcoal-efficient stoves to people in Haiti who cook with stoves within their house.
Okay.
They cook with, like, open-fire stoves. You know what I mean? That's an awesome performance metric, because it's real change. Like, you see it.
What made you decide to link up the specific, like, there are specific colors for each charity? How did you come up with that idea? And was there, you know, some of them may flow pretty naturally. Like, you see pink with breast cancer awareness a lot, you know, but what were some of the others that made you kind of think of the natural pairing there?
You know, one of the ones I think would be a great feature for Slug Magazine is the yellow one, right? People always ask me, like, why did you do yellow for water? That doesn't make any sense. Why did you do blue? And I said, no, you did yellow for water in order to symbolize the struggle, right?
So all right.
Yellow is the color of the jerry cans, which are used in Africa or India, where people go from, like, their village to the water source, and they take these jerry cans. That's why we use yellow and we didn't use blue.
found many people who have ordered multiple watches, so they've got one for every outfit, or you know, are they priced in a way that people will do that, or?
Yeah, they're definitely, I mean, they're $40. The thing is with the pricing, since you said that, like with the pricing, right, the pricing is something we cannot change ever.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, my only goal is to meet these metrics. So when I say one watch feeds 16 children, one watch will always feed 16 children. The pricing will never change, because if we were to change the pricing, the metrics would get messed up.
Yeah. That makes total sense. And I saw, you know, I looked at some of the other products that you've designed. A lot of them have, like, recyclable packaging, things along those lines. And the One Face, you know, these products are all promoting responsibility among consumers. Is this something that you see as a growing trend for other businesses?
You know, yeah, definitely. As far as social good products go, you know, if you were to, it's a very large growing market, right? And I think this year it's about a $3 billion market cap, and it's a very fast growing market, because at the end of the day, the consumers in an economy that we're in now, you know, being a recession, depression, whatever you want to call it, and it's only getting worse.
Yeah.
So now it's like the consumer in the first world country sort of feels the pain, or sort of feels the struggle of how people in the third world feel every day. So now when you tell a consumer here in America or in Europe, like, hey, you could do this and it'll benefit somebody, now I feel like they're jumping on it more, because it's, you know, they have that in their psyche now. Like, oh, wow, I can also do that. So it's a very large growing market. My only concern with it would be, you know, how other companies structure their business model.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we did the whole metric side of things, because that is, I mean, honestly, I believe that is the best way to structure it. If there's another way, I would love to know. Like, I love the one-for-one business model, but at the end of the day, that still leaves the consumer asking a question, and then what? That's one thing I never wanted to happen. I don't ever want the consumers asking, and then what? We are telling you what, and then we are literally showing you what.
So where can I find the One Face watch?
If you go to onefacewatch.com and click the buy watch, it'll go to the Indie page, so Indiegogo. So we launched a crowdfunding leg of this first, because, I mean, I'm sure you know all about crowdfunding and whatnot, Kickstarter and Indiegogo and
yeah,
all that.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, we launched a crowdfunding leg of this first, not because we needed the money, but because this is not about us. Right? This is about you. That's what I said in the video. This is about you. Like, this is about the people. It's not about us. So we just felt like crowdfunding was a good way to, like, do the pre-launch and whatnot. So, I mean, that's what we've been doing right now. So 13 days. I think there's 13 days left as of today. That'll keep going. I think it'll probably close out at, like, over a quarter mil or something like that. And then after that, it's going to be retailed online as well as in stores. So right now we're in talks with Urban Outfitters, Macy's, Target, and JCPenney.
That's great. It's great what you guys are doing with these watches. It's really fantastic work, and I hope to see it influencing other businesses as we're going through time here. Is there any other information on how to get more involved with the charities that you're working with that are benefiting from One Face?
As far as getting involved with those charities, I don't know, a lot of them are the larger charities, so they got their stuff going. We always have people that we take on as, like, interns, or even there's been a lot of people just contacting us, like, oh, how can I help besides buying the watch?
Okay.
So we do have, like, certain strategies that we've implemented that people can do, you know, just on their own. I mean, realistically, at the end of the day, it's just about sharing it on your social media. It's pretty much what it is. It's just getting the word out. Because, I mean, the product speaks for itself. The brand speaks for itself. You know, it's been doing very well. And it resonates well with the consumer. Like, for example, when we launched this, right, on Instagram, we got over 5,000 followers in 3 weeks. That's unheard of. So it's very interesting to see, like, where your core demographic lies, how it's attracted to you.
To purchase one of the watches, read more about the charities they impact, and learn more about what you can do to help, visit them online at onefacewatch.com. Thanks for listening to Soundwaves from the Underground. For all things Slug Magazine, visit slugmag.com. What's your favorite all-ages venue in Utah? We'll be doing an upcoming episode on all-ages and underground venues, and we'd like to hear what your favorite spot is. You can either send an email to soundwaves@slugmag.com or call and leave us a message on our automated voicemail line at 858-233-9324. You can leave a message 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and we just might play your message on the show. This podcast was created by Slug Magazine, produced by Gavin Sheehan. Associate producers are Esther Moronio, Ricky Vigil, Alexander Ortega, and myself, Dan Nalen. Executive producer is Angela H. Brown. The theme was performed by Birthquake and recorded by Jesse Ellis. The main logo and art design is by T. Doan, and technical design by Kate Colgan. Join us next week when we'll be talking to Aldine Strychnine, talking to the boards and the Salt Lake Spitfires. Thank you very much.